Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Gnar Trees podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations is an 18th century work of political economy that became the foundational text of modern economics. First published in 1776, it examines how wealth is created, distributed, and expanded through labor, exchange, specialization, and market institutions rather than by simply accumulating money or precious metals. The Modern Library edition presents this classic in a format aimed at contemporary readers while preserving its original intellectual scope. Smith's purpose is not to offer a narrow technical manual, but to explain how economic life actually operates within society, including the roles of competition, prices, wages, trade, and government. The book is also a broader argument about human behavior and public order. Individual self-interest can generate social benefits when markets are allowed to function within a stable legal framework. Because of this combination of economic analysis, moral philosophy, and policy critique, the work remains central for readers who want to understand the origins of capitalism and the logic behind free market thinking. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, wealth comes from productive labor, not from storing gold or controlling trade. One of the book's most important claims is that national prosperity should be understood in terms of annual production and exchange, not in terms of hoarded treasure. Smith rejects the mercantilist idea that a country becomes rich by accumulating bullion or tightly controlling imports and exports. Instead, real wealth grows when people produce useful goods and services, then trade them in ways that expand output and consumption. This shift in perspective is decisive because it moves economics away from static stockpiles and toward active processes. Wealth is something generated by labor, specialization, and circulation, not merely preserved in vaults. Smith uses this argument to criticize policies that protect narrow commercial interests at the expense of the broader public. He shows that attempts to control wealth by government decree often distort incentives and limit overall productivity. The deeper implication is that prosperity depends less on ownership of money than on the capacity of a society to organize labor efficiently and exchange freely. Secondly, the division of labor is the central engine of productivity. Smith's analysis of the division of labor is one of the book's most famous contributions because it explains how output can rise dramatically when production is broken into specialized tasks. Rather than having each worker perform an entire process from start to finish, specialization allows people to focus on specific operations, improve their skill, save time, and use tools more effectively. Smith's example of manufacturing, especially the pin factory illustration, demonstrates that productivity gains come not only from hard work, but from organizing work intelligently. This insight matters because it connects economic growth to structure, not just effort. The division of labor increases efficiency, but it also depends on the size of the market. Broader markets support deeper specialization, and deeper specialization supports broader markets. Smith therefore treats productivity as a social phenomenon shaped by coordination across many workers and firms. At the same time, his analysis hints at a limitation: specialization can make labor repetitive and narrow, which later readers have seen as a human cost of industrial organization. Even so, the argument remains foundational because it explains why modern economies can produce so much more than older ones. Thirdly, self-interest and the invisible hand can coordinate markets without constant direction. A major theme of the book is that individuals pursuing their own gain do not necessarily undermine the common good. Smith argues that under conditions of competition, secure property and legal order, self-interested behavior can be guided through prices and market exchange towards socially useful outcomes. This is the basis of the invisible hand idea, a metaphor for the unintended coordination that occurs when many people independently respond to market signals. A merchant seeking profit may invest locally rather than abroad, and in doing so, may support domestic employment and output without intending to serve the public. Smith does not claim that self-interest is always noble. Rather, he shows that market institutions can harness ordinary motives for productive ends. This is one reason the book remains influential in discussions of capitalism. It provides a mechanism for explaining order without assuming central planning. The idea is not that markets are perfect, but that decentralized decisions often produce more effective results than direct control. Smith's analysis is therefore both descriptive and normative, explaining how markets work and why their freedom can be socially valuable. Fourthly, government has important but limited duties in a commercial society. Although Smith is strongly associated with free markets, he does not argue for a society without government. Instead, he assigns the state a specific set of responsibilities that are essential to economic life. Government must preserve justice, protect society from external threats, and provide certain public works and institutions that private actors would not reliably supply on their own. This includes infrastructure and other collective functions that support farmers, but do not yield immediate private profit. Smith's position is important because it avoids a simplistic reading of laissez-faire. He is not saying that all intervention is harmful, but that intervention should be carefully justified and not used to protect monopolies, restrain competition, or favor entrenched interests. His criticism of excessive regulation is tied to his belief that policy often serves producers rather than consumers. At the same time, he recognizes that markets require a legal and institutional framework to function at all. The result is a balanced but disciplined vision of government, strong enough to secure order and public goods, limited enough not to distort the natural operation of exchange. Lastly, the book connects economics with moral philosophy, politics, and social order. The Wealth of Nations is more than a technical study of prices and commerce. Smith writes as a moral philosopher, so his economic reasoning is embedded in a larger inquiry into human behavior, justice, and the organization of society. He is interested in how wealth affects classes, wages, rent, and national power, but also in how institutions shape incentives and civic life. This wider framework is part of what makes the book enduring. It treats economics as inseparable from politics and ethics. Smith examines how commercial society changes the relationship between individuals and the state, how competition affects public welfare, and how laws can either support or undermine prosperity. His critique of monopoly and special privilege is therefore also a critique of unjust power. Readers often find that the book rewards careful study because it does not reduce society to one principle alone. It combines empirical observation, historical comparison, and philosophical argument to explain how modern economies emerge and what conditions allow them to function well. That breadth is a major reason the book still stands apart from narrower economics texts. In conclusion, The Wealth of Nations is best suited for readers who want to understand the intellectual origins of modern economics rather than a simplified summary of market ideology. Economists, students of political theory, historians, business readers, and general readers interested in institutions will all find value in it, though it rewards patience and careful reading. Its practical benefit lies in how clearly it explains core mechanisms still central to contemporary debate specialization: competition, trade, prices, wages, and the limited but necessary role of government. Its intellectual benefit is even broader, since it shows how economic systems can be analyzed as part of human society rather than as isolated mechanisms. What distinguishes it from many later economics books is its combination of analytic depth, historical scope, and moral seriousness. Smith is not merely defending markets. He is explaining the conditions under which markets can serve public prosperity. That makes the book more durable than a simple policy argument. It remains essential because it helped define the language in which modern capitalism is still discussed, criticized, and defended today. If you would like to support Adam Smith, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.